The Theosophical Society presents Mr. John Coates in a talk entitled, The Changing Field of the Future.
Well, this convention is intended to be around the idea towards a living theosophy. And I think we must think to ourselves for a moment what that means. And it is in relation, really, to this title that I have chosen, the subtitle of this talk today. First of all, I think the word that counts in that phrase, towards a living theosophy, is really the word living. And what is life? Life is a process. Life is a process of renewal. Our bodies need food, we have to eat, in order that we may have strength and so on to go on. The cells of our bodies, and indeed cells in other things as well, grow and change and die in plants and animals as well as in ourselves. Even perhaps the stars come and go. Stars appear, new stars, and old stars appear to die out. We're in a universe in which changes are perpetually taking place. And life, it seems to me, means change, essentially. Life can never be static. Life can never stand still. And where it supposedly stands still, then there is stagnation and what we call death. So, in regarding the work of the Theosophical Society, it seems to me that we must never stand still. And yet, I would dare to say that in the conduct of our Theosophical Society, in different parts of the world, in various lodges and groups and so on, we run the risk sometimes of stagnating. We are not always up to date in our contact. We very often follow the same old ideas and the same old methods that we've been following for 30 years. And then we often complain that we are not doing as well as we would like. Now, I feel that however good some of the old methods may be, we must not get into the habit of relying upon them entirely and fail to realize that with the changing world in which we live, it is essential that new methods and new ways be found. We are entering into the last decade of the first 100 years of the existence of the Theosophical Society. And people have already written about 1975. We talk about it. We wonder what's going to happen. We are perhaps caused to think by a statement such as this, when HPB writes, well, she's talking about the possibilities of advancement amongst her students, and she tells them that they only have up to the end of the century, that's the last century, in which to attain certain things, and those who will not have reached a certain point of spiritual development, or that point from which begins the cycle of adeptship by that day, those will advance no further than the knowledge already acquired. No master of the wisdom from the East will himself appear or send anyone to Europe or America after that period. And the sluggards will have to renounce every chance of advancement in their present incarnation until the year 1975. Such is the law, for we are in Kali Yuga, the Black Age, and the restrictions in this cycle, the first 5,000 years of which will expire in 1897, are great and almost insuperable. O people, reading that statement, may perhaps rightly expect that there will be some special effort in 1975. And I think we very readily, because we have wishful thinking about this, we very readily suppose that our society is going to be closely connected with whatever effort is made, as we are told both by Madame Blavatsky and indeed by one of the masters, that such an effort to illumine and help mankind is made at the end of every century. But if you think about what has already been suggested to us about previous efforts. We have heard of the past centuries of names like Christian Rosenkreutz and Roger Bacon or Francis Bacon, Constant Germain, who have been concerned evidently with efforts in different centuries. We may perhaps pause to think, because even though it might be shown that some of these great personages were linked on the inner side, and perhaps even on the less inner side, in such organizations as Freemasonry or the Rosicrucian organization, the original one, it isn't very easy to link them outwardly. It isn't very clear what outer links there can have been between the work of Sir Francis Bacon and the Concert Germain. When the Theosophical Society was founded in the last century, and it is said to be the effort of the last century, there is very little clear outward connection between the society and the work of the Concert Germain in the previous one. Have we any real reason to suppose that whatever effort is made in this century must be linked outwardly to the previous effort, which is ourselves? I don't know that we can assume that this is bound to be true, although we may hope it is, and certain statements have been made in theosophical history which can certainly give us such hopes. But I would have thought that our usefulness to the future effort, whatever that effort is to be, will depend very, very largely upon how ready we are to take over and to be able to enter into whatever is presented anew in those days which lie ahead of us. Perhaps 10 years, perhaps 15 years, we don't know. The world is changing very quickly, and what we might call a new field of our work is developing. It's so easy to look forward and be conditioned into thinking that the world of tomorrow is somehow going to be more or less like the world of today. And I think as decade follows decade in this century, we see, on the other hand, that the changes are rapid and cumulative, and that the speed is always getting greater. I think in the 1940s or the 1950s, early 50s, we should have been surprised had we known how far science would have developed today by this 1965. So I think that it is very necessary for us in the Theosophical movement to see the future in a very loose sort of way. That is to say that the field is going to be so different from the field we have now that our efforts in it will have to be very, very much adapted and possibly changed. Probably we need a far greater flexibility in our work. Theosophy as life is a sort of flow, and a life stream must flow. You dam it up and it stagnates. We need to plan, but we have to hold our plans lightly, because some great change may take place overnight, and we shall have to adapt our plans to a new field, because it is the field in which we work which is changing. I would like to tell you a story, because we mustn't get too serious, and we can allow ourselves to laugh. It's a story about some Boy Scouts. Some of you may know it. You know that Boy Scouts are supposed to do a good deed every day. And so the scoutmaster was asking these small boys what they had done for their good deed. And so he said, "Well, Tommy, what did you do for your good deed?" And he said, "Well, sir, I helped an old lady across the road." He said, "Well, Tommy, that was a very good thing to do. I'm sure that was very helpful. And now, Johnny, what did you do?" And he said, "Well, sir, I helped Tommy to take the old lady across the road." And so he thought a moment and said, "Well, Johnny, that's all right, I suppose. I don't really know whether it needed two of you, but still, that's all right. We let it go." And then he came to little Robert and he said, "Now, Robert, and what did you do?" He said, "Well, sir, as a matter of fact, I helped Tommy and Johnny to take the old lady across the road. And so by this time, the real interest of the scoutmaster was aroused. And he said, Robert, surely it wasn't necessary for three of you to help the old lady across the road? And he said, oh, yes, sir. It needed all three of us because, you see, the old lady didn't want to cross the road. Well, you see, the point is that it would be perfectly possible for the Boy Scout to be so determined to do a good deed that he forced a good deed, as it were. And I think that in this way, we also, you see, can become so determined on a course of action that we force the future instead of allowing the future, as it were, to express itself freely. And so I feel that it is worthwhile, for a little while, to consider the possibilities of this changing field, which surely exists in the future of our world, and therefore exists for us. You might look upon it as a series of crises which are already in some measure upon us, and mention has already been made of them in this convention in the symposium of yesterday afternoon. Someone spoke about computers. I would link this up with the whole idea of automation and the problem of leisure and responsibility. Clearly, all big corporations, big business houses, and so on, are going to invest in these machines because they save time, they save labor, and they are presumably supposed to be more accurate. This is bound to result in more and more people either having to change jobs or perhaps to wait between jobs or even to lose jobs. And in some countries, this is going to mean very much more hardship, perhaps, than in others. And we may well consider what people are going to do with their leisure. Now, I can't answer for your country because I simply don't know. But speaking for some countries that I do know, I would think that there is no very great evidence to show that people with more leisure use it more constructively. I would think, on the contrary, even in my own country, that people with more leisure spend more time going to football matches, more time looking at the television. And they are not so obviously interested in a constructive use of leisure. Of course, there may be many, many exceptions, there always are. And I think that one of the problems of our age is the unwillingness of many people to accept responsibility. It's terribly easy to pass the buck. It's terribly easy to get somebody else to decide for you. It's very easy to allow everything to committees, who very often don't decide very much. No reflection here upon the American section, I may say. It's very easy for us to escape and say, it's not my job, let someone else do it, and sit back. And we may perhaps wonder why there is this lack of a feeling of responsibility, which I personally meet in very many places. I think it may have many explanations, one of which perhaps, in some countries at least, is due to what we would call the welfare state, where more and more the government is taking over individual responsibilities. One of our members in France told me last January that if a family there is, I was going to say clever enough, perhaps not that's the right way of putting it. At any rate, if the family has a large number of children, up to about six, I think, then they receive so much per week, per child, from the government that no one in the family has to work at all. Now, this seems to me to be pushing the welfare state rather far. And it is a notable fact, although it may have perhaps many other causes, that in advanced countries like Sweden and New Zealand, speaking in terms of welfare states, they have the highest suicide rates in the world. I don't know whether, from a theosophical point of view, we can connect this. Perhaps we may. Perhaps it is that the ego about which we speak, which are really the true essential selves of you and me, come down into this world to do a job. They come down to take responsibilities, to undergo certain problems and troubles, to learn this and learn that, go through suffering and so on. But if this responsibility is removed from them by the welfare state, then perhaps there is a feeling of frustration which might even on occasions lead to suicide. I think there may be other contributory causes and explanations, of course. But I think that the welfare state, which should rightly perhaps be doing things for people who are badly crippled, for orphan children, for blind, and so many different causes which are wholly, wholly worthy, perhaps can err by doing too much for the individual and taking responsibility off his shoulders so that he no longer feels responsible. And then I think another thing which causes this irresponsibility is the entertainment world in which we live. Millions of people, growing millions all over the world, sit listening to the radio and looking at the television. And although we may get interesting programs, we sometimes do, we also hear a lot of rubbish. We are subjected to the most extraordinary advertisements, which really make you feel, I think, ashamed for humanity. Really, that... There's sometimes something degrading, really, in the kind of advertisements to which we are so often subjected. But even though we may have interesting programs, we are obviously delighted to hear the news, we get good music and so on, I should think that the cumulative effect of all this is that we become slowly, slowly, slowly conditioned to receiving. So that we're always receiving. We're always having other people entertain us or tell us or amuse us or scandalize us or shock us or annoy us, whatever it may be. It's always coming to us from outside. And we are not thereby stimulated, as I think from the theosophical point of view, each individual should be stimulated from inside out to become more creative in his attitudes to life. And the same, to some extent, is true of the field of sport, where relatively few people do something and the rest of the people just sit and are amused. And there's possibly a third factor, and that would be the religion, especially perhaps in the Western world. And whether you belong to a high church or a low, even though you are enjoined to lead a good life and so on, in the final analysis, some tremendous responsibility is taken off your shoulders. Because in the act, according to Orthodox Christianity, in the act of dying on the cross, Jesus, in fact, paid a price for you. And whether you look at it from the point of view of Roman Catholics, or you look at it from the low churches where you have to simply believe in the blood of Jesus, whatever that may mean, you are finally relieved of this ultimate responsibility for yourself. Although the issue depends, in some measure, upon your way of life. And I don't think that any of these things encourage us to accept responsibility. I don't see how they can be changed. We are up against insolubles from one point of view. The only change can come in ourselves and in our reaction, and perhaps in the example of our lives as far as other people are concerned. But I think this is one of the problems of today, and possibly it is one which will grow more serious as we move into the future. I would like to look at one or two things from the point of view of how they may affect our field of work, but necessarily, of course, they are things which affect the world as a whole. Then there was the space age, which was also referred to yesterday. It is a very extraordinary thing, I think, that whereas perhaps only 10 years ago you read in science fiction or in children's comics about people who went to the moon. Here we are today literally discussing where we're going to land on the moon, and a date is being fixed for it, and so on. The advance is enormously rapid. And I should imagine that when people have been to the moon, and particularly, and this is of course a very, how shall I say, a very serious part of what I'm saying, when they can be brought back from the moon safely, then I think this is going to have an enormous effect upon the thinking of the world. Even though even we, theosophists, claim to believe in a larger cosmos and so on, and even though so many books have been written, and all the astronomers look at the stars and so on, I should think that the majority of people vaguely assume in their hearts that this Earth is the center of things. And I think that if we go to the moon, which means we can go to Mars, means we can go into the further stars eventually, perhaps, it's going to cause an extraordinary revolution, a widening of the horizons of humanity. Just, I think, in the direction that we in the Theosophical Society would wish. It may perhaps make the field we work in easier. A crisis of youth was referred to. At least I call it a crisis of youth, because it is that, I think, and it is everywhere. And strangely enough, this is just as much in Moscow as it is in the capitals of the West. It's a crisis which is linked very much to a change in values. There's always a rebellion of youth against an older generation, of course, but this time it seems very much more profound, much deeper. And one of the great problems I think we have to face is the need to review the difference between freedom and license, because this I don't think is clear. Especially it is not clear to many of the young people of the world. The situation is so different today from what it was. The education has changed greatly. We have generations amongst us who have been brought up against a scientific background rather than against a classical one, which perhaps our grandfathers were brought up in. They are bound to look at the world through different eyes. They are bound to assess things, like religion, for instance, in a different way. It can't be otherwise. And therefore, what flowers from this background is almost certain to be in some measure in conflict with what flowered from the background of those of us who have white hair. And it is our job to understand and realize that it must be so, and not to attempt, as many people do, to try and hinder it. Perhaps we may on occasions offer some word of advice, but it has to be very carefully done. Now, some of you perhaps remember an answer given by Dr. Besant at a Chicago conference, I believe, I don't know how long ago, and she was asked about the young theosophists, and this was her answer. The thoughts of the young, boys and girls, represent the future. They may be crude, but their thoughts will be in advance of the thoughts of the average older person, who tends to represent his thinking as the principal thought of the day. Now, we're the average older person. We think our thinking is the right thinking for today. Dr. Besant says that the thoughts of the young will tend to be ahead of ours. The young people will very often be unreasonable, very hasty, very impatient, but they are the citizens of tomorrow. Advise them sometimes about action, but never check their free speech. Let them say exactly what they like. Most of us will be cremated and in our graves while they are still working. The more they can think and discuss while they are working, the more they will learn. Let them be over-enthusiastic, for the world will kill that soon enough. Encourage them to give themselves great ideals. and you will build up the America of the future. This is the kind of sympathy they want from us. The young will not express themselves before their elders, and the less you say don't to them, the better. This indicates the kind of attitude, I believe, that we should have, and perhaps some already do have. We may complain, and many people do, about the extravagances which we find amongst many young people in the world. But surely we have to try to understand this. I don't know what it was like when you were at school. Did you have to do as much work at school as your grandchildren or your children do today? I must say that I did not. I find children tied up in many countries in Europe till 10 o'clock at night doing their homework, or having been at school all day long, with no time for fresh air, no time for games, no time for anything but work. I don't blame those children on Saturday afternoons or Friday nights, whenever it is, and they go off and rock and roll and twist and all this kind of business. I don't blame them for this. They've got to let off steam. They are cribbed, cabined, and confined in the life that they're forced to live during their educational period, all too often in many countries. It may not be true here, that I wouldn't know. And all alongside this, they are subjected to endless, endless, endless advertisements such as I have referred to. Sometimes they're accused of being too loose in their sex relationships. But I can't say I feel that I can blame them entirely. They are subject to pressures which you and I were never subject to. The world has changed. Scientists, rather than individuals, has definitely had an effect on the dogmatic acceptance and of Orthodox religion. It doesn't play such a part in the lives of millions of people today as it did play once upon a time. On the other hand, we have every advertisement encouraging us to have this and do that. And so many of them have a kind of sex background, whether it's the beautiful lady smoothing soap all over herself, you know, or various things of that kind. I don't think you can even see an advertisement for a very manly thing like a tobacco pouch without its being offered to him by a lady with a beautiful bosom. You can't get away from it everywhere, anywhere. And all our young people are subjected to this, and if they're at all normal, they can't help but be affected by it. Now, our civilization says, oh, well, you can't get married, you know, until you're old enough to keep a wife and buy a home and do this, that, and the other, take out some insurance. And when is that for the average young person? Well, it may be anything from 5 to 10 years after the time when nature says to him, you're ready for that kind of thing. And we have created this in our civilization. And it is, well, I'm a believer in discipline. I'm a believer in self-control. I'm a believer in all sorts of things of this kind, absolutely. But I don't think you can ask the impossible. And therefore, you have to try to understand. And I think that we in our theosophical movement should be very active in trying to create a world in which these things don't happen. Because the world we have today makes them almost inevitable. What can we do? We have plenty of guidance, but we have to work very hard, make our voices heard in many places as best we can. This is a problem of tomorrow in the field in which we shall have to work. I don't pretend to have all the solutions. I regret this. How could one? But I think that you probably have as many good ideas about it as I have. But we need to work on this. I think we shall have a crisis in regard to the nature of God. I think that science, in a sense, has taken God away from us and has not yet put him back. That is to say, inevitably, and here they're playing right into our hands in the theosophical world, they are moving more and more people away from the idea of a personal God, which is no longer acceptable in the old terms, and are presenting to us something in the nature of a universal law which expresses itself in manifold ways through all the wonder of the universe. And this is much nearer, perhaps, to the idea of God which we in the Theosophical Society might care to recognize. I think we shall see a revolution. It is already starting, and it will presumably change the field in which we have to work. I think we may find that such an orthodox community, for instance, as the Roman Catholic Church, already changing greatly in these last few years, may well come out with the teaching of reincarnation. I don't know whether I ever told you before, but one of the bishops of our liberal Catholic Church, Bishop Hounsfield, who lived in the south of France, had as his friend for many years the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris of the Roman Catholic Church. And this man was returning on a journey from Rome, and he stopped off in Monaco and had lunch with Bishop Hounsfield. And Bishop Hounsfield told me that one of the things he said was that they had been having a lot of discussions in the Vatican about changes of policy, and that one of the points reviewed was whether the time was ripe for the reintroduction, not the introduction, the reintroduction of the doctrine of reincarnation into the official doctrines of the Church. And they decided against it. They looked to India, where, of course, reincarnation is considered as a law, and saw that in its effects, it very frequently caused people to put off to tomorrow what they should do today. And they looked at the Roman Catholic world, and they thought to themselves, there are just as many people here too, who might probably put off to tomorrow what they should do today. And so they decided the time wasn't yet ripe. But perhaps, through efforts of organizations such as ourselves, and many others in this field, they may feel that the time has become ripe. And what a difference this might make to the field of our work if they should come out with this doctrine, presented, no doubt, in their own particular way. I think we shall see an increasing change in the world of medicine with the development of more and more delicate instruments, which will perhaps finally be able to show, if not visibly, at any rate in some way, the nature or the existence of an invisible man. The growth of psychology, psychiatry, and psychosomatic medicine are proving that man is not just a body. And although everybody hears all these words, perhaps the people as a whole have not yet fully accepted the fact of this, that man is not just a body, but he is a composite creature. His mind affects his body affects his emotions, and illness, as it were, can be transferred from one to the other. And this, I think, is going to be shown more and more as we move into the future, changing the field in which the theosophist may seek to present his ideas upon the bodies of man. We shall surely have crisis in population. I don't know how that will affect us, but I think we can expect it. Is it not true that in all the fifth races and rounds and chains, we have what we might call judgment days? And we are now in a fifth sub-race of a fifth root race, even though it's only a fourth round. But it is a mind on judgment day, and in all such judgment days, you expect to see a great increase in population, and a great increase, perhaps, in that element in the population which we would think of, perhaps rather wrongly, perhaps unwisely, perhaps conceitedly, as less evolved. Those people who are being born into a particular examination period in which they have to prove themselves as fit to go on with all the rest of humanity into the future on this particular planet, or at this particular period in our planet, or whether they will, as it were, be laid aside for the time being like apples on a shelf, waiting for some other civilization which more suits their needs. So I dare say part of the reason for this population growth and so on is accounted theosophically in this way. But it is certainly going to prove a problem in the world. and certainly also in relation to food. We shall see changes in India, I've no doubt. Some of them perhaps will not be all that we would like to see. We have the growing effect on groups such as ourselves and in a certain group of thinking people throughout the world of Krishnamurti and his teaching of, what should I call it? I call it the immediate, the need for awareness at all times of what we're doing and saying and thinking and why we're doing it and saying it and thinking and so on. I think the numbers of people who go to listen to Krishnamurti, whether it be in India or Switzerland, where he is now speaking at this time, is growing very greatly. And this may have an effect also upon the future of our work. I want to tell you a story of visiting the convention of the Italian section last year, when our brother Sri Ram presided. But the other speeches at the convention, given by the General Secretary and the Vice General Secretary and the other leading speakers, were all on the subject of the early teachings of the Masters and the presentation of Theosophy through Madame Blavatsky. And I asked the General Secretary afterwards why this concentration. And he said, when our section was being built up, Dr. Besant was already in the saddle, if I may put it that way. She was writing books, C.W. Leadbeater was writing books, and naturally, with our limited funds, we translated into Italian the books that were current, the books which seemed to be new, the books which were coming out year by year. And the result of this was that we didn't so readily find ourselves able, first of all, to print, and later to study the original books written by HBB. And he says, I find this leads to a sort of unbalance in our society, that very large numbers of the members only have what he called, I suppose, a Besant Leadbeater view of Theosophy, and they did not at all have an early teaching HBB view of it. And he felt this was unbalanced, and that he had to do his best to restore the balance by concentrating for the time being on presenting the teachings of Theosophy as they were originally presented by HBB and in the letters and teachings of the Elder Brethren. Now, I found this rather interesting, and I have a feeling that the same thing may happen in other countries. And this may also change, perhaps, the way, if not the field, at any rate the way in which we approach the future. Now, one could elaborate, no doubt, more on some of these ideas, but the clock is moving on very fast. We are torchbearers of tomorrow and torchbearers into tomorrow. And our work won't end until it is truly finished. There's a hymn that some of you know, and the last line of each verse is, "Till the earth shall be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea." And this is really true for us. Our work, some people decry it, some people like to say, oh, the work of the Theosophical Society is finished, it's had its day, and all this kind of nonsense. At least I think it's nonsense. Our work will go on until the earth is filled with the glory of Theosophy, if you like, as the waters cover the sea. Till all men know who they are, that they are no less than the sons of God, partakers of the one universal reality and life, and must come to live as such. The society will always be concerned with the same truth, because there is no other. It is the ultimate reality of the one, and all that stems from that fact. But the apprehension of truth, the presentation of what a seeker may, indeed must find, that certainly has to change. And it is we who have to change it. We, the members of the Theosophical Society. I was going to take a little time to look at the objects of our society, but I haven't really time to do this. I think perhaps we can view them in a slightly different way, without in any way seeking to change them, so that we look at our first object in terms of relationships, human relationships, and even other, that our brotherhood extends not only, as it does in the first place, to all other men, but that it extends to the other kingdoms of nature as well, all of which are the embodiment of the same one life which manifests itself in us. So we have relationships of all kinds, man to man, man to God, man to animal and plant. But in terms of brotherhood, about which we talk so much, what really matters, surely, is that we live as brothers. And this is the question we can ask ourselves each day. We go to the market, we travel in the bus, or a train, an aeroplane. We're in the office, talking to other people, in the home, dealing with people all day long, each of whom is our brother. Do we, in fact, live as a brother? Or do we content ourselves with talking about brotherhood? The second object becomes, from this point of view, an object of occult knowledge, in which we are concerned to learn more of the universal plan, the law, the evolving hierarchies, the evolution of life and form, and all those things which are part of the study of the Theosophist. But beyond this, surely we have to be awake to what is happening in the world around us, that we may try to substantiate as best we can the tenets which we hold. Of course, there are groups interested in doing this from the scientific point of view, and I'm no scientist and I cannot do this. But I do think that we can keep our eyes open and pick up little tidbits. And I'm going to suggest to you here just one thing which came to me from John Kuntz, the son of Dora and Fritz Kuntz. He gave me one day a map of the bottom of the Atlantic, which had been prepared through many years of work by your Navy and had been published by Columbia University. And it shows the bottom of the Atlantic with all its ridges and its hills and its valleys and so on. It shows the Hudson River going out into the Atlantic for hundreds of miles in an ever-deepening canyon, which proves, at least I hope it proves, to a non-scientist like myself, that canyon must once upon a time have been above the water, because I can't see how a river can wear a hole through the rocks when it's underwater. It surely must have been in the air. And there are many other interesting facts to be learned from this map, which really show us, I should think with a fair measure of proof, that there is land now under the water which was once above it. Now, this doesn't prove all that's been written about Atlantis. Of course it doesn't. But it does help us to substantiate the possibility of an Atlantis when we're talking to people who are inclined to ridicule the idea. And in this kind of way, we can pick up tidbits of information which help us in the presentation of our ideas. And the third object becomes the object of yoga and fulfillment. Man's knowledge of himself, derived from individual experience of his own inner nature, the awakening to a new consciousness, the seeking of the path or the mystic way by the individual within himself. Well, I haven't time to elaborate. We must work in these changing surroundings with new tools, new methods, new books, until all men everywhere give not only lip service but tribute by the acts of their lives to the basic truth emergent from the society's aims. All these aims are established in the idea of the One. The first object is the application of the fact of the One. The second object is the integration of the knowledge of the One. And the third object is the experience of the reality of the One. And we shall continue to influence the world we live in with our philosophy, and one hopes by the example of our lives, so long as we continue to adapt ourselves to the changing field. Views on race and religion will change. Science will concern itself less and less with weapons of war. Education will acknowledge the unique quality of every child. No longer will economics of greed hold so many in thrall, and man will work for the benefit of the community, and his leisure hours will be spent in the wiser understanding of and the living of life. As we allow life to express itself freely through our society and its work, molding ever newer forms to meet the changing future. So shall we help to bring nearer that time when we shall truly be able to say that the oneness of the self is known.